This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Verb. 45 minutes of language in all its forms laid out for your enjoyment and delight. There's poetry, prose, discussion and ideas that would otherwise fall between the cracks. This week we're in that land called the subjunctive, and I thought I knew what that land was. I thought it was a kind of miasma of language that was vaguely hopeful, but in the end I didn't know that much about it. But by the end of the podcast, just like me, you'll know so much about the subjunctive, it'll be your specialist subject on Mastermind. Ian McMillan, specialist subject, the subjunctive, thanks to The Verb. Welcome to The Verb. Now, it's been called a mood that expresses possibility. People use it to talk about things they wish were true. It's a state of mind that imagines a future that might, just might, happen. It's the subjunctive, and its sisters are the imperative and the indicative, and I think they get a bit impatient with the subjunctive gazing out the window looking for a less buttoned-up world. So this is a subjunctive verb, and my guests are all, in their wishful way, fans of the subjunctive. I'm joined by the novelist Toby Litt, the poets Holly Pester and Mena Elvin, and our verb linguist in the house, Dr. Rob Drummond from Manchester Metropolitan University. So, Rob, could you explain to us what the subjunctive is? Because we're going to be hearing two pieces of specially commissioned writing based around the subjunctive. So how will we spot it? What are we looking for with the subjunctive?
As you said, it's a mood. It's known as a mood. So that suggests the speaker or the writer has some kind of attitude. It expresses some kind of attitude to what's going on. And as you said, it's something to do with maybe something that's wishful, or it expresses hopes or expectations or demands or recommendations. And there's a very kind of standard way of thinking about the subjunctive. It would be in a sentence like, Ian recommends that you listen to the verb.
Mm.
The problem is, it's hard to spot in that sentence because what makes it different is that, the verb in that sentence, so listen, doesn't have the third person S. So
right.
you wouldn't notice it in Ian recommends that you listen to the verb because we would say you listen anyway. But when we say Ian recommends that Holly listen to the verb,
right,
then that's where it comes into play. Because in a standard indicative mood sentence, Holly listens to the verb.
Yes.
I listen, you listen, but Holly listens. But in the subjunctive form, we have Ian recommends that Holly listen to the verb. So that's the most standard way of it being used when it's some kind of recommendation, and that's called this mandative form. So it's a recommendation or a request or some kind of order. But then there's another form where that people think of as the subjunctive, which is sometimes called the past subjunctive. But that's not really accurate, or the were subjunctive. And again, in traditional grammars, something like, I wish I were rich, or if I were you, I would do this. And that's seen as the subjunctive. And that's where we're going to have to be a little bit careful. There's two ways of thinking. In traditional grammars, that's seen as the subjunctive. It expresses something that's unreal, it's counterfactual, and that's fine. More recently, grammarians have decided that's not strictly speaking a subjunctive. So with my kind of strict grammar hat on, I'd have to say that's something called the irrealis were, the way of expressing something that isn't real. But with my kind of more stylistically literary hat on, I could say that that is, for all intents and purposes, because that's how people understand it, that is a kind of subjunctive.
And it does seem to me the purpose and existence of the subjunctive is much more clear-cut in other languages, such as in French or Spanish. Is that to do with verb endings or word endings? So they can define them on the page more easily than we can.
It is. In different languages, the subjunctive still, you know, lives in quite a strong way. So in French and Spanish and Italian, all of these Romance languages that are based on Latin. But English being primarily a Germanic language, so it comes from a different sort of family. It's a bit of a mixture, to be fair, English, but it's more Germanic than anything. English doesn't have the same reliance on word endings. We have a very strict word order in English, and that means we don't need so many of the grammatical cases. If you think of whom, for example, we don't really need whom. Whom is something that's kind of holding on. And it's
a mail for that, you will.
It's not necessary.
Speak up for whom.
It's not necessary. But in other languages where there isn't such a strict word order, you'd need to know that this word is referring to the subject or the object of the sentence. But we know in English, we know whether it's the subject or the object because of the order of the words. So in other languages, which do rely on different case ending, verb endings, you know, a greater set of moods, different moods, then it's more common and it's more frequent.
So I wonder what our guests understand by the subjunctive, because it feels to me what we've just been talking about is that it is full of possibilities. So, Toby, is that how it is for you? Is it a possibility-laden thing?
Oh, absolutely. And dreamy, and it invites people in when you start talking about, you know, if I were. In fact, I think the subjunctive is most powerful when you don't complete the sentence. And I think that's why the lyric goes, if I were a rich man. I don't need to say, I'm going to sing what I would be if I were a rich man. I think it definitely has that.
And Mena, what is it for you? Yes. How does it feel for you?
Similarly, I'm thinking of Welsh poetry, and people's poetry is full of that kind of wishful, those kind of verb endings. Pan elw I fi Gymru nôl, when I go back to Wales, there's a lot of nostalgia, melancholy within Welsh poetry right through to the 6th century. And that, again, is a sense of mood and yet a sense of possibilities, of hope, of another world possible.
I love the idea of grammar, which we often see wrongly as a set of rules, as some kind of ring-fenced thing, actually being something as beautiful as a mood. So what do you take, Holly, from that idea of the subjunctive?
Well, thinking about it as a mood, but also a mode of thought or an approach, I can feel the melancholy in it, actually, because it's speculative in that it's about the future, but it contains an idea of the past, if I were. But the idea of the past that it contains feels fantastical or a fantasy or a wish in itself. So it's that kind of oscillation between hope and loss that I kind of feel in it, which is melancholic.
And there's a Welsh word, hiraeth, which most people know is nostalgia or some place that perhaps never was or a place you want to go to. And the meaning of hiraeth really is long field, and it's like looking towards the horizon, what's beyond, and writing poetry is all about imagining what's beyond and what's possible and where you can't go back. To where you were, the things change.
Yeah. And Rob, there's that line in that Tennyson poem, Mariana, where he writes, I would that I were dead, which seems like an old-fashioned way to express a desire, but it also sounds very literary. But I know that you've suggested in the past that the subjunctive is disappearing not from the literary form of English, but from the spoken form of English. Why do you think that is?
Because it's not necessary, and that's the problem. And the same with whom. The subjunctive isn't actually necessary. There's ways of expressing what the subjunctive expresses. There's different ways of expressing that. So, you know, the idea of language being this living thing, there might be things that we like to hold on to, but we can't change it in any way. It will change the way it's going to change, and people can battle against it, but you're fighting a losing battle. You're really kind of swimming against the tide with this. So there's no way of doing that. So when something becomes unnecessary, not always, but often when something becomes unnecessary, it ceases to be used. So younger people aren't using it as much. I would imagine that the few subjunctives that will cling on are things like archaic phrases, so things like God save the Queen and so be it, and all of these sayings, which are subjunctive, but people don't really know it's subjunctive, it's just a fixed phrase. I have a feeling that this sort of subjunctive that I've said, strictly speaking, isn't a subjunctive, but for the purposes of today, I feel I don't want to kind of put a dampener on everyone's wishfulness. So if we're going to say that if I were, we'll give that kind of honorary subjunctive status just for today, then I have a feeling that one might remain, but again, as a fixed phrase, because I would imagine there's young people, I don't hear it in the young people I work with, but I can imagine them still saying, if I were you, you know, that could still hold on. They might think it sounds a bit stuffy and formal, because that's the other thing. You know, when I say the subjunctive isn't necessary, even that one can be replaced with if I was you, which people of a certain age might kind of bristle when they hear if I was you. But that's what younger people are saying, and that's the way it's going. And that's,
so they're hanging on because they're kind of little packets of language,
exactly,
that they've not opened up to examine, but they're just saying them anyway.
Exactly, it's just a phrase. In the same way that God save the Queen, who mm-hmm. would have known that was a subjunctive? That's just a thing. It's, we think of words being the units of language, but a phrase can be the unit, and it's just a fixed phrase that doesn't really get dissected anymore.
Let's add the first of our specially commissioned subjunctive pieces from Holly Pester. This is first person heartbroken, wanting, hoping, fearing that second person heartbroken does something.
First person heartbroken, wanting, hoping, fearing that second person heartbroken does something. You would that you were the one who could stand this. You might break as if in flight, and were you, you would be ridden by the flight, orted out of lost oblique pieces, wristed by memory to remodel its images. If the dream scene is thinkable, then there's hope we cut the time took of our marvellous future. When you take 100 cars to the trunk of a sick tree, not carer nor brother to the thought, but mourner and artist, you who want the dream for action rather than the act, cannot cry again. Carry on with love adjacent. It might be you who dreamt that you dry your sheets without touching them. The dream said it looked as if you'd talk to your sheets to dry them, and they stare back in fear that they stay suspended to the thought that they stay dry all the long February, that you might creep back into your conditions all the long January. You are the first person who could feel that you differ in action. You suggest to yourself that this is an old life, you ought move the car, and the age of the life, away from the dead tree, into another sort of order. The dream said, what imaginative work, but if I were the tree, I would hope you carry the tree, as if you were the tree, out of its romantic condition, away from the mournful suspension of possible order.
Holly, that was great. So how did you approach them when we gave you this brief to work with the subjunctive? How did you approach it?
First of all, I'm going to say it's difficult. It's hard. This was a hard poem, and it's a hard thought to kind of sustain. I still feel like it's ongoing, actually, and I feel almost haunted by the subjunctive now. But I think I was thinking in the mode of the as if, and thinking about that kind of as a philosophical approach. So thinking about that dialectics of hope and regret that the subjunctive seems to carry, and thinking about that as an experience or a paradigm of that experience, thinking about heartbreak and post-love and that time being based on a memory, but the memory becomes a sort of substance of future thought and future ideas of possible love. I'm also very influenced by the surrealists and surrealist thinkers like Aimé Césaire, who talks about alternative worlds and thinking beyond as a way to better examine material reality, because I still think we need a mode of thought that addresses what lived reality actually is. I'm in conflict a little bit with the subjunctive and the indicative. But it's still an ongoing thing, as you can see. It's got in me.
Well, because it feels, as you say, it's still a work in progress. It's in flux. It feels unfinished in a good way. So that's because, I think, the subjunctive opens up endless possibilities. And once you delve into it, then there can be no end to it, in a way.
And that's what I love about poetry. It's like as soon as you open up a thought or you invent a paradigm of an experience from something you feel, then, yeah, you've opened up portals and temporalities infinitely. And that's why dream space, it's like the subjunctive being kind of dream thought. As soon as you have those kind of realities in play as well, then you can do all sorts of kind of poetic work and imaginative work with images and possibilities.
Because the poem begins, you would that you were the one who could. And that use of you... So who is the you that's been addressed there? Because the repetition of you throughout the piece makes it very powerful. But who is the you?
Who is you? It was in first person to begin with, and I think that that second person evokes the aspect of the subjunctive that is suggestive and sort of inserts a possibility into the mind of the other or the imagination of the other. And I felt that having that kind of more communicative or direct communicative voice to the poem brought in that subjunctive mode that, you know, it would be good if you did this. That's slightly kind of passive instruction to imagine the scene or the scenes.
Because that line, if the dream is thinkable, then seems to be key to the piece. Somehow the piece seemed to be about a dream isn't thinkable, a dream simply happens. But by writing about the dream, using the subjunctive, you begin to think the dream somehow.
You begin to think the dream. And this is that dialectics of hope and regret. So the dream kind of provides some sort of environment to do some thinking about your lived reality, or however destitute that may be as a thought. But the dream space provides materials and invention and potentially radicality to take back into a more indicative thinking.
Rob, where in the poem did you think the subjunctive made itself felt most?
Well, I think in this poem, it's more a case of it's invoking the idea of the subjunctive, even if grammatically some of the aspects that we think of as maybe being subjunctive actually weren't. And I feel a little bit like, you know, say you had a beautiful piece of jazz music, and I feel like somebody who's coming along and trying to annotate all of this and deciding, spending too much time deciding whether this is a semiquaver or a demi-semiquaver and missing the whole point. And I don't want to be that person because, you know, this is what's happening with the grammar. I think we can look at the grammar too much and decide, well, OK, strictly speaking, yes, that one is a subjunctive and that one isn't.
You can correct
and
my
missing the whole point of how beautiful it was. And so I think the most common use of something like the subjunctive in poetry is this if I were, is this unreality, this counterfactual, this hypothetical, which, OK, so whether people say it's strictly subjunctive or not, it has that, it invokes that idea of wishfulness, of idealness, of not quite sure whether something's true or not true. And so I think all the way through, whether strictly grammatically they were subjunctive or not, it had that idea, it had that sense, which I think is a lot more important, to be honest.
And the writing of it made me realise that the subjunctive is actually it's very hard to carry scansion and the subjunctive seem to work against each other, because the weight of the verb is at the other side to where you might, I don't know, it feels like the line has to kind of carry the weight in strange places where you'd want the verb. And that was quite a fun sort of unwieldy material, and I felt like scansion and that kind of verb form or verb mood was wild.
I was intrigued by that line, ought move the car. Which you'd expect would have been ought to move the car. So why did you write it as ought move the car?
I was looking at poets that do use the subjunctive, and I know you're going to talk about Emily Dickinson, but that kind of clipped phrasing that actually feels like it signals so many more temporalities than the more specific the line could be. If you put the verb to be in at any point, I feel like you're pinning it down.
So ought to pin it down more. Ooh. Is that right, Rob? As a grammatical thing, if you take the to away and just leave the ought?
I would say that invokes this subjunctive idea because it mirrors it. And this is a case where I would say it's not strictly subjunctive, but it's mirroring aspects of this. It's taking aspects of the subjunctive, like taking that verb, that kind of bare form of the verb without to, without an S on the end. And so it's invoking that idea of some kind of wishfulness or counterfactuality.
Yes, I feel the whole poem is about desire, isn't it? It's kind of trying to weigh, balance desire and reality, and they kind of clash, don't they? And I think desire wins through because it's kind of open-ended.
Yeah, and do you know what? It's about heartbreak because I was looking in my initial research into the subjunctive, reading some French phrases. They give you just example phrases. A lot of them just felt really like desiring, pineful, I hope you stay. Mm-hmm. I want him to stay. if he stay. And it's like, why do they keep going on about this person staying? Mm-hmm. But so I was left with these kind of echoes. But I do think that time post-love is full of the desire to remodel memory and to fantasize of a future based on a memory that actually evacuates the memory. So that kind of desire that you speak of, yeah.
If you look up examples in French, that it's all about this, you know, these kind of examples. If you look up examples in English, they're all about demanding and suggesting and ordering. It's those kind of things.
And Holly, you often work with sound manipulation. You've done pieces for us in the past doing that, and yet that was simply your voice. And was that because, in a sense, the subjunctive was enough? The subjunctive was enough to carry everything for you?
It provided a kind of phonology as well, just having to sort of mechanise that in a line and letting these feelings of hope and speculation and fear and mourning as well come through. But I think when every word carries its and just like the loss of the S at the end of a verb, that is a kind of sonic play as well, and the difference between ought and ought to becomes a field of sort of sound play as well.
My fervent wish and hope is that you're enjoying this subjunctive verb. If you want more of this kind of mood, download our podcast from BBC Sounds, where you can hear more work from Menna Elvin. I'll be there, hopefully. See what I did just then? I'll be there, hopefully. Toby Litt, now, you wrote us a piece some years ago in which we allowed you only to use one verb in the entire piece. You were working with a restriction. It seems to me, though, we asked you to write something using the subjunctive, and that opens up language and ideas. So, in a sense, did you feel restricted by this piece, the commission?
I did, because I found myself in syntactical and temporal knots, because you sort of hem yourself in. And I wrote something where I wanted something to happen, definitely, at the end, but I had to kind of break it. I had to force it to happen because it stayed in the speculative and it stayed in the regretful for a long, long time. I tried to be subjunctive as much as I could, but I think I've slipped into other things, and I wish I'd been more irrealis, because I like the idea of these grammarians sitting deciding. You said very different. The grammarians decided. I immediately thought of a papal conclave where those who follow grammar were waiting outside to see what colour the smoke would be. Hang on, we're waiting for if only. Yes, it's black smoke. It's not the subjunctive anymore. And I've if only'd a lot.
Now, your piece, Toby, is narrated by the first person. So who is this I that we're going to hear from?
If it's anyone, it's a bit like an imaginary ghostly version of me 30 years ago.
Give us the title. It's a great title.
Love Subjunctively.
Love Subjunctively. Let's hear it.
If only I were a different person, I would find it easy to tell you what I feel about you, but I can't. I live in the subjunctive, the lonely, ghostly silence of if only. It's where I've always lived. It's where I was brought up. My childhood home, the castle, would have been a very different place had there been any communication between the east and west wings, apart from sporadic gunfire between the ballroom and the servants' quarters, my mother and father's favourite sniping spots. Given different parents, ones who actually spoke to one another without lawyers present, I might have grown up with a less idealised vision of love. With no actual role models around me, I was forced to turn to fictional ones, and tragically, the castle was equipped with an extremely well-stocked library. If only I could have spent my mornings conversing with actual human beings rather than Romeo and Juliet, Quasimodo and Esmeralda, Charlie Brown and the little redhead girl. If only I could have played sardines in the dovecot with some specially bust-in village children rather than cuddled up with Cyrano and Roxanne. If only I could have flirted experimentally with second cousins rather than started keeping a diary. How much more well-balanced I would have been. How much more prepared for meeting you. Instead of this, down the long oak corridors, my mother and father and their designated legal representatives could be heard wailing the words, "But you can't have the Gainsborough as well as the Matisse," and "It's not cosmetic surgery." By the way, that last wail could only have come from my father. How differently to this I imagined them. Imagined a handsome father taking me aside for manly chats in the gun and rod room, addressing me as fruit of my loins. From him I would have learned important life lessons. For example, never change the blade in your razor the night of a first date. Bloody toilet paper on your Adam's apple, my boy, adds a no-no. Imagined a beautiful mother confiding her girlish hopes and dreams in me, her only son, during twilight promenades through the knot garden on matching ponies called Ache and Throb. From her I would have picked up those great secrets I never learned before it was almost too late. For example, my darling, always listen when a young woman is speaking to you, because she might actually be trying to tell you something you very much need to know in order not to be a complete bellend. Oh, it was vital during those formative years that I be liberally schooled, yet it was not to be. My teachers were nuns from the local convent. My fencing master was the Mother Superior. I still have the scars. And so it was even more important when I left home for university that my fellow students knock a few of the rough edges off the shy young man I was. However, this too was not to be. For before anyone had a chance to break into my silence and frighten away my ghosts, there you were, walking real as real into a lecture on Paradise Lost. Modest, friendly, your small hands pink from the cold. From the very first moment I saw you, I was thinking of all the things I might say if only I were able to speak. Things like, which is your favourite Jane Austen novel? And which is your favourite adverb? But the damage had long ago been done. Back at the castle, back in the library, all that could have been remained stuck in the if only. Unless it might be that you might reply to this small note that was never intended for you to read, but that I might just possibly leave under a book on your desk in the university library tomorrow-ish?
Very good, Toby. Gosh. Those two words, could and would, feel like the backbone of that piece, these quintessentially subjunctive words. I wonder if there are things then that you can say in there that other sentences couldn't have done. Once you launched into the subjunctive, you were able, I think, to open up, we've talked about it in the programme already, but there was concrete evidence of it, opening up these prose possibilities, I guess.
Well, I think, obviously, I was trying to have some fun and be a bit silly, but the more specific you get once you've launched into the subjunctive, like the name of the ponies or whatever, the more ludicrous it becomes, because it doesn't exist, but you're building more and more castles in the air. And the more vividly you describe them, the further out you've sailed. And then somehow you have to recover from that in the next thing you say. And the only thing to do, for me anyways, go a bit further.
You look at the end of the piece. Unless it might be that you might reply to this small note that was never intended for you to read, but I might just possibly leave under a book on your desk in the university library tomorrow-ish. That both opens and closes the possibility of something else for this character, doesn't it?
It does, and I never did. But I wasn't sure in that sentence, because that's the one where I'm trying to wrangle it back round into being an action, but try and keep it subjunctive. And I think it probably goes into being conditional or something slightly more debased. But the idea is that it leaves the reader to yearn for them, that person, to make contact. And I think that, as Holly was saying, I didn't start out this intending to write about love, love subjunctively, but it seemed to call me to do that because it's a mood of regret or a mood of yearning towards something, and those are sort of the emotions of love.
So then if you wrote a novel entirely in the subjunctive, it would never end, would it? You could never, it would be like Finnegan's Wake in a different way. You would have to keep going round and round because nothing would get concluded.
No, it's hard to touch down from it, but once you're up there flying along, being sort of blown through the clouds around this castle you built in the air, it's nice there. You're sort of able to indulge yourself. And I found the sentences, this has been cut a little, but I found the sentences unspooling because I was encouraged to go just by the fact that I didn't have to check what I was saying against some reality somewhere. I was able to go off on one completely. And that does open up for me the idea of writing something extended where it never has to end. You know, what if I were? How would it be if?
It wouldn't work in a crime thriller because the reveal would be, what would that the butler were the killer? He might have done it. So there's certain genres it wouldn't work in.
I don't think Agatha Christie even got round to that torturous version, although she played all... I thought she'd played all the variations you possibly could on the murder mystery.
And in the piece, you suggest that a literary life that the character is leading is a kind of subjunctive life because the protagonist is living through the possibilities suggested in these books rather than in real life. And Holly, we mentioned Emily Dickinson briefly earlier. That makes me think of her, the 19th century American poet, because she seemed to live this subjunctive life. She lived, in reality, as a recluse. In her imaginative life, the poetry felt infinite, didn't it?
Yeah, and all her poems, well, because a lot of them were letters and or notes and fragments, and so they do kind of have that sense that they're prophetic, but also they always feel like quite oracular but cryptic and in all those ways that I suppose do speak to the way that she lived. And feels like now, it feels like it speaks to you so closely and so intimately, but also comes from a very sort of ethereal space.
And Rob, one of the ways that Dickinson infers a subjunctive is in the omission of that final S, as we've hinted at earlier. So when winter shake the door, it should be shakes, then a softness suffuse the story, should be suffuses, and only the sea reply. So how does that omission of the S fit in with what we've been talking about in these kind of nebulous rules, not really rules, of the subjunctive?
I think that's a perfect description of what's been going on. As I've been sitting here listening to the poems and then with Toby's poem, thinking, you know, is right in terms of it's actually more irrealist. You know, from a grammatical point of view, it's more irrealist than subjunctive. but then I'm thinking, you know, why is it so important that this term subjunctive should describe such a narrow, sort of small set of structures? The way we're using the subjunctive in this conversation is much wider, is much broader, and it's much better in a way. And so this idea that somebody could live subjunctively, as you said, it's just invoking those ideas of wishfulness. And so in terms of Emily Dickinson and those missing S's, I think the same with everything today. It's been invoking that idea of subjunctive. The subjunctive stands for something. And by making these small tweaks to the grammar, even if it's not strictly subjunctive, it's invoking the sense of that subjunctive. And I think that's what she's doing, and I think that's what's been happening in some of the poems we've heard today.
And so that is the difference then between when we're talking about the subjunctive as a thing and the subjunctive mood. So the mood is kind of what we're all floating about in today, isn't it?
I think that's a nice way of thinking about it. And we know that there's going to be grammarians listening to this thinking, well, they just haven't grasped the subjunctive.
Hi.
And I would say, and I would. Well, that's it. That's the way I'm thinking now. I would just think, well, the grammarians who are worrying about this are just missing out on a whole other area of how language can be used in a more stylistic way. And I think that idea of invoking the subjunctive and living a subjunctive life is a lot more interesting than somebody recommending that you do something.
Mena Elvin, your poems are suffused with the subjunctive because I think they're full of hope and possibilities. And I wonder if that relates almost counterintuitively to the fact that you're writing Welsh, because people talk about Welsh being an endangered language, and yet your poems seem full of hope. They seem subjunctive in that way.
Writing in Welsh has never been safe or cosy. It's almost seemed as if it was an underground culture for other people. And yet it's thriving and diminishing at the same time, not poetry, but the language itself. So that, in a way, is a challenge. And I'm thinking, when you say subjunctive, I'm thinking of subjugated, you know, that the language was oppressed, silenced, and the fact that I am voicing in Welsh through translations in various languages gives it not only hope, but shows a way of connecting with all the small nation cultures around the world, which is why my poetry from English is translated into other languages.
So that's interesting. What you said then, it's both flourishing and not flourishing at the same time, because it's flourishing in the literature, most definitely, but the number of native speakers is declining, is that right?
Numbers are declining, but there's hope. I mean, the Welsh government wants the 500,000 who currently speak Welsh to be 1 million by 2050. I don't know if you'll get there, but that's why writing in Welsh is being a revolutionary and a survivor at the same time. And it's challenging, but it's also thrilling because you're touching subjects that haven't been written about in this language before. One of my books of poetry in 1977, a whole book was about miscarriage, which hadn't been written about in Welsh ever before by a woman. And so there are things that we can do with languages that are minority but have a long history that is rich in vocabulary and in register and so forth.
So Welsh then feels particularly suited to the subjunctive, do you think?
Definitely, and connects with, you know, we're talking about Spanish and other languages, Italian and Basque as well. So there is that connection and that understanding of similar moods and hopes and possibilities.
And so if you have a poem that's in Welsh and then translated the same poem into English, which we have in your book, you'll see then a different subjunctive happening, maybe, from one to the other.
Yes, and very often. But I like to think of them as, the Polish poet said, you know, they're second originals. They're almost new poems in their own right with the subjunctive underlaying the poems.
Could you hear Nebish? And that title on the English version is in fact a Yiddish word, but in the Welsh it's Nebach. So what's the significance of those different titles?
Well, this is how this poem began. I came across the word Nebish, the Yiddish for poor soul, poor man, or Nebach. And Neb in Welsh means nobody. Ach means to belong. And so I wrote this playing on those words. One of the first words you learn speaking Welsh is the word bach, which means small, but it also means dear. So I'm playing on that word as well. Dysgu rhedeg yr yrfa, bach, lleied, llai, lleiaf. Ond pwy yw'r lleiaf honno? What I learned early on was small is small, smaller, smallest. But who is the smallest of us all? We thought it was us, the Welsh, appendage, some relic or other of England, sometimes quipped as Great Britain, although minuscule on any map. Welsh is the only language you learn to be able to talk to fewer people, said one spin doctor. Or the journalist, this useless language, though she could not sound even a syllable from her small world. Bigger, bigger, bigger is the curse that we hear. These days, the small and smaller are afoot, and we are with them. The smallest ones, dregs whose hiraeth for hearth wants a roof, eaves even bondo and blessings, who crave, though they be small, a feast, a dwelling, a plenitude, and we like them shy away from those who sense the leaves on our lips. After all, we Welsh were called strangers once by our next-door neighbours, so we understand those on the move, mumbling without the warmth of their mother tongue, glasswort on a faraway beach, every shard hitting rock before it falls in the cauldron of tides. Until the great power reconfigure their dictionaries as the diminutive people, small, small, the smallest nebbish, a nobody, nebach, no lineage, smaller than small. Poor things, say some as they bid adieu to the whisper of the tiniest tribes and nations. before slipping back to their huge world, larger than ever, 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 cyn troi nôl at ei byd mawr, mwy, 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 os oes mwy.
Now, you translated that poem yourself, didn't you?
Yes,
in
I
the
did.
Book, they're not all translated, but
well,
by you.
I tend not to translate my own work, but something happened. One of my translators got ill, and I ended up having to do it to get the book out in time. But I avoid translation, otherwise why write in Welsh in the first place, although, of course, I teach through the medium of English at university, which is a bit of a contradiction. I teach other people to write well in English, but I write in Welsh myself.
I was going to ask you about that, about the odd times when you do translate your own work. Is that a thing you would do as an ongoing thing? So you've written the poem in Welsh, you're writing the poem in Welsh. Is that a completely hermetically sealed thing? Or at the same time, would you be thinking, if I had to translate this into English, this is what I'd put? Or would you do it always a long time or after the poem is finished?
It's an afterthought and afterwards. And because I translated myself, I had the freedom, although I do allow my translators a lot of freedom, but I was able to free the poem up in English in a way that I, perhaps, a translator wouldn't have.
It's funny today, Rob, we've been talking about, we set off saying that maybe the subjunctive was on its way out, and now because we've been celebrating the subjunctive, it feels like it's there. But do things like the subjunctive and other grammatical principles come and go, or do they simply just go? I was thinking about some of these lost letters like the pilcrow or something that disappear, or is there a chance that it can come back?
I think in everyday spoken language they just go and they don't come back. But I think what we've seen today echoes the idea that in poetry and in literature that's where things hang about a lot longer. Mm. And they might never go. From some of the things we've listened to, you know, there's no way that people are going to stop using the subjunctive, even this very broad sense of the subjunctive. It's not going to suddenly stop. Even if younger people aren't using it in their everyday language, it'll still hang around. And the same with all of these other expressions, these other grammatical structures, which aren't needed, but that doesn't mean they don't serve a purpose.
And so thinking about Welsh, which is a very ancient language, do we know how old the subjunctive is as a grammatical form in English? For example, would Chaucer have used it, or would the person who wrote Beowulf have used that?
My understanding of older versions of English is that it used to be used much more, and as English has developed into the language it is now, the subjunctive has gradually disappeared because we have other ways of expressing what the subjunctive used to express.
Let's hear one more poem, Menna. Could you read Unravelling? And this is from that sequence you wrote about the Abervan tragedy in 1966, when the slag heap engulfed a primary school, killing 116 children and 33 adults. And the poem opens with that line, those two lines, with the Bible ready always on her tongue, and the idea being someone who read the Bible and knew the Bible well. And is that reminiscent of the idea of an older language that's remembered only by a few?
Yes, known by very few people, that the word for death, my grandmother's time, was datod, to unravel, which is a kind of metaphor of life ending. And Aberfan really was my starting out as a poet when I was 15, and listening to what had happened in Aberfan, and it, of course, resonates with Grenfell and Pillsborough and all these other tragedies. So this is Unravelling. Datod. Ar Beibl yn barod yr eithafo, datod, oedd gair mam gi am ddarfod, wrth iddi gris groesi pwythau ar liain rwyllog. With the Bible ready always on her tongue, mam gi's word for ceasing to be was datod, the great unpicking. She saw in her mind as she cross-stitched an open weave stitch on her cloth. A gentle word, surely, for a life stripped bare, the letting go too soon to sleep. Then, when I heard the news, I thought of the woman's work, of sewing labels on coats, on trousers, on dresses, attaching names to property, drawing the slack buttons together, so they be not lost. How friable is cotton? How bloody is the needle which unfolded silks, clothes of cotton and wool, unravelling lives, too small to be out there in the cold.
Thank you very much to Mena Elvin and to my other guests, Toby Litt, Holly Pester and Rob Drummond. Next week, we've got somebody who'll be playing musical bricks in the studio because it's the 200th anniversary of the birth of John Ruskin. That's what's known in radio as a tease. We'll see you then. Don't forget your word, Hod. Thank you very much, Mena, for staying around for our podcast. And what poem are you going to read for our podcast listeners?
I'm going to read a poem called Love Not. And it's about the fact that many women, myself included, when they want to fasten a necklace, need another person to help them. So it's a love poem. Cloyd Serch, translated by Gillian Clark.
All right, let's hear it.
Cloyd Serch. Bob bore mae hen serch yn rhodd o'r newydd fel y gadwyn allaf i gwisgo heb gymorth cymar. Each morning, old love is a gift renewed, like the necklace I can't fasten without love's help. The clasp and I don't let me believe I can fix it at the nape alone. It needs this ritual, the unison of two, the secret lock that lets the necklace lie on my breast, a hidden knot that binds two lovers. Through generations, this simple duty, this task, lover to lover, a moment's work for finger and thumb. Were they made, I wonder, these lovely beads in another age, so that this ritual for two would become common ceremony in cave or private chamber? To find two parts at the nape, to see them linked, to caress in the act of closing this orderly commitment. On one another, dependent as a necklace. Love's need and plead a chain, glowing beyond pearls, renewed, unbreaking. Sy'n estyn ymhell tu hwnt i unrhyw berle, gan ddisgleirio o'r newydd heb ofni'r dryllio.
That was beautiful, Mena, thank you. What are our reactions to it round the table? Because what I thought about was that we often hear about, quite rightly, poems about young love. And new love and first love, but here's a poem, old love, you know, continuing love. That just felt so moving.
What's drechia, the last word? The last word.
Drechia is to shatter, of course, unbreaking is the English. Not fearing the breaking is the Welsh, but Gillian has just renewed unbreaking. But the Welsh is gan ddisgleirio o'r newydd heb ofni'r dryllio without fearing the shattering.
So shattering more than breaking
yes,
in the Welsh.
Yes.
So a stronger word in a sense.
Yes, I don't dare study. I do quibble with some translations, but sometimes I leave them because...
It reminded me of medieval poetry in that something like the Pearl poem where this idea of jewellery, jewel, a precious pearl without and price, is about a lost child in that. But it made the art closer to the craft. So this idea of making jewellery or something would not be seen as that high art like poetry. But it's that the linking thing. It's saying, well, this thing in the world forces people to be intimate in this way. I'd never thought of it like that.
I was just thinking about how nice Welsh sounds. Really, I think when I'm not ruining everyone's fun with rules on the subjunctive, I spend most of my time with speech sounds. I work with sounds more than grammar.
Yeah.
And I think Welsh. I've always thought Welsh is a particularly pleasant sounds too dull, but a really kind of attractive sounding language. Mm. It has some lovely sounds.
Well, we still say composing a poem. We don't say writing a poem. You know, it's still that sense of music.
Yeah,
is
I think it
so
is
a, important.
Yeah, it comes across as a beautiful language.
Surely that, Holly, the sense of music in the language.
Absolutely, and I train myself to say composing and composition rather than writing because I feel exactly the same. No, I loved that poem, and I was just thinking, that's sad. No one's ever done my necklace up, and I've never struggled. I've just trained myself to be alone. But I liked the line, a moment's work, for that kind of effort and the labour of the difference of doing it, doing it for someone is so easy, but doing it yourself is I thought that was really interesting in that, as a kind of wider metaphor for sharing labour and you know, the work of love as well being a kind of effort, but also all labour being kind of shared in that way.
I once almost, but not quite, wrote a poem about the same thing where I was fastening the necklace on my wife's neck and actually accidentally pinched her and the blood was drawn. So that would have been... it was an idea. As I'm doing it, I thought, should I write a poem about this? But I didn't, I'm pleased to say, because yours was much better in that genre. I think we can have some cake now, if anybody like any cake.
Thank you very much for downloading the Verb podcast. Head over to BBC Sounds for more Verby delights.